Chauffeur. 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 Check what's above. Chauffeur.
The River Inni rises in the uplands of the Evora Peninsula and winds its way down through the Inni Valley to the Atlantic Ocean, just north of Waterville. As it travels, it runs through an area rich in plant and animal life, in legend and lore, in ancient Neolithic and Bronze Age sites, and later Christian settlements. And it's a river famous for its trout and salmon. I followed the river in the company of expert botanist Dr. Therese Higgins. Local farmer John Sheehan took us up to the rugged slopes of Knockmoyle, where the small tinkling streams that feed the river have their beginnings. Well, here we are, Therese, and what a view as we look across to the magnificent range of the Macillicuddy Reeks, spread across the horizon in the sunshine, and way below us on this gorgeous autumn day, the Inni Valley, spread out in all her gold and russet hues. We're standing here on the grassy slopes of Knockmoyle. John Sheehan's gone off with his dog to tend to his sheep, and we're right by one of the many small feeder streams that flow into the River Inni. Therese, how does a river like the Inni form?
Well, JJ, what we're looking at, I suppose, is the western end of the Macillicuddy Reeks, which are one of the many mountain ranges that we find here in the southwest of Ireland, which would have formed hundreds of millions of years ago when tectonic plates clashed together and pushed up, folded up, broke the surface of the earth, if you like, and shoved up some of the components. And you can see in the landscape around us that there's a lot of rock close to the surface. Vegetation has covered some of it. And rivers form, well, in two ways, but surface rivers like the River Inni form when water on the surface of the planet all flow towards the lowest point. So where mountains are and the slopes are quite steep, a lot of water runs down the sides of these into the lowest points, and they run along the lowest point, following the land down towards the coast, towards the sea, where the land is at its lowest. And what you can see here in this riverbed is that most of what we can see at the moment of this high is rock, because although the water is trickling down, this is just one of many streams that will come together further down the land to form a wide channel that's full of water. Most of what we see are boulders and cobbles and stones, which have been, some of them moved by ice actually long ago, more recently by water, and the water is trickling down them. And then after a period of heavy rain and flood, of course, the water level would rise so that it would fill most of this kind of gouged out channel that we can see here on the side of the mountain. And so the river would grow both over time, you know, it would have been born sometime after the ice retreated at the end of the last glacial period about 10,000 years ago, and that the land was free again, if you like, and warm again, and water could flow as water. And these streams would gather together and flow downslope. So the river is young here, I suppose, in that it's near its source, so there's a small volume of water. But as we go downstream towards the sea, lots of feeder streams will come together, making that channel bigger and wider.
I also met with archaeologist Evan Lamb to look at some of the ancient sites along the riverbanks and valley. We began in the uplands of Tuachtlan to look at a fairly spectacular example of Neolithic rock art.
Even seeing rock art as often as I do, after traipsing through all the bog here and crossing the streams, it was really amazing. Even from a distance, or very unusually, you can see this rock art from, say, 20 metres away. And I'll just describe it a bit first. There's a central hollow. They're called cup marks. They're larger than the size of an egg cup, but they're only maybe a centimetre or a half deep. And then the most spectacular motif on this rock has a ring around it. People often describe it as being like the ring in a cooker. It's about that size. And then beyond that, there's another big ring. So we have what's called a cup mark with two concentric rings. It's so dramatic and so clearly carved out against the rest of the rock. It's an impressive sight to see in the middle of this bog at the end of a valley with like nothing of humanity to be seen anywhere. And over the rock face, there are more of these hollows. And they're so clear to see. You can actually see how they were pecked with a hammer stone. So this is going back to the Stone Age. So we're talking 5,000 years ago when these were carved. Because of the fantastic sunlight today and the way the sun is shining on the rock, can you see that there's this glitter, there's bits of glitter shining throughout the rock everywhere?
Well, as soon as you mention it, of course, I do see it. Yeah, it's glittering all over, little tiny specks.
Current research into rock art, there's a fashion at the moment to look into the senses, the sounds that were made during its making and the sounds that were in the area at the time. So this one here, it's very common for a rock art to be beside a stream. So we can hear the tumbling roaring of the stream. Water must have been also a sacred substance. So now you have the rock and the water beside each other. And you have the acoustic effect of making the rock art. And then on top of it, you have the dust that comes from making the carving. So I've done some experimental work and in a rock with mica schist, like this one here, when you see this little glittering comes up in the light of the sun. And when you actually make a carving with that, you get covered in a type of glitter. Now, I wouldn't say it was the main reason for the carvings. I'd say the carvings themselves are the symbolic and the sacred. But a byproduct could well have been this glittering material, which again, you know, it was 5,000 years ago. So, you know, glitter would have been something, again, to make awe, would have been awesome. That glitter comes from the mica, M-I-C-A, in the rock. And it leaves a glitter all over you. So if you make rock art and you use rock with mica in it, then all of that will be all over your clothing.
Only guess at the purpose of these markings and the meaning these sites held. Perhaps they were the place of ceremony or sacred ritual, and if so, we can only guess at the form such ceremonies may have taken. Would music or chant have been part of those rituals? And if so, how might that music have sounded? One of the most ancient musical instruments found in Ireland was discovered just over the mountain from here, the Derrynane horn, as it's come to be known. It's a curved cast bronze wind instrument, and it was discovered in Derrynane here on the Evora Peninsula and dating, we think, from about 3,000 years ago, which still makes it 2,000 years younger than the man or woman who made these ancient rock designs. The curved shape of the Derrynane horn puts me in mind of the ceremonial ivory horns that were once heard in the royal courts of Uganda. And we do know how they sounded. It's tempting, perhaps I'm too eager, but it is tempting to think that perhaps the ceremonial sounds from Uganda give us a clue, maybe only a clue, as to how the music accompanying ancient ritual may have sounded in this remote place in the foothills of South Kerry where our ancestors gathered and carved shapes into rock that bestowed a new meaning and significance on this place. We're very fortunate with the weather today.
The light at this time of year is marvellous. It's lower in the sky and the slanting rays of the sun really pick up the motifs. You know, as we can see here, we're getting like a really gorgeous sharp picture. This one is so good, you can see it in all lights. And then the growth, there's the dieback at this time of year. And that really helps for all of archaeology. Ring forts really become apparent. You know, if you're going driving around at this time of year, if you look left or right, you'll see lots of features in the landscape. Stone-built enclosures become apparent. And then in the summer, it's the bracken, really, that grows so high that makes them invisible. So if you come down here and look at this rock just by the side, it's got exactly the same motif that's on the main face. It's on a completely different level. But here again, there's the cup mark with the ring and then a second ring around it. That's very unusual in the rock art motifs. And we can see it so well today because of the way the sun is at this time of year. How they were made is now thought to have been by quartz hammerstones. So excavations have been conducted. Everyone was fully expecting flint to have been used because flint is so hard. And quartz only is a possibility, but not alone was quartz used, but the quartz hammerstones were actually left at the rock art. So that must have been, if you like, a ritual deposition rather than just being dumped there. And in rocks which have fissures, say cracks in them, the hammerstone's been placed in there on purpose. It's actually put in there as some, again, as some kind of deposition, and sometimes even covered with other stones as if to protect them.
Down here, by Mullina Brac, the streams have already formed a very discernible river, and we're also looking at a very different landscape from the uplands, Therese.
Yes, JJ, the landscape here has changed, and so too has the river. It has matured, it's bigger, it's maybe 8 or 9 metres wide, and the water now is the dominant feature rather than the boulders, in that the water is covering the river channel. The landscape has changed too. It's much more sheltered. We're on flat ground here now. There are shrubs, there's willow trees and gorse and bramble on the banks of the river. It's still quite stony below, which is a good sign, and it's an important feature of the river as a wildlife habitat because it means that the water is oxygenated. When you have a very silty bottomed river, you get a different set of environmental conditions and suitable for different living things, and this is just how it should be at this stage, young in the river's life. And it means that the water is oxygenated right down to the base of the water column, and that allows things like fry for fish and other invertebrates to live in the water.
So are you saying that the water quality is very good here?
It is. It's pretty good, and it's been shown to be good. It's monitored. Most rivers in Ireland are monitored by the Environmental Protection Agency regularly, and this river has good reports all along its length. We can see that by the fact that the water looks clear And the fact that when they assess the river to see how good quality it is, what they actually do is they disturb the bottom of it and they take out all the little creatures, the larvae of damsel and dragonflies, of beetles, fish fry and so on, and they count and score those different species. And certain species will only tolerate very good quality water, and by having a good number of those species present you get a high mark. So that's how biologists do it. But you can see it too, the fact that it's a stony bottom here, not a silty bottom.
So the cleanliness of the water, the quality of the water, isn't measured by the amount of fish in it, it's by these invertebrates.
Well, yes, because the invertebrates that are at the bottom of the food chain in the river, if you like. Unfortunately, fish, the salmon and the trout and things like that, are suffering in the other part of their habitat, which is out to sea. Salmon and trout spawn inland in rivers and then spend a lot of time maturing at sea and then come back up the rivers again to spawn. Really, I think the rivers in Ireland have stayed pretty clean, not pristine, but pretty clean in general. And really, but where we're seeing fish losses, it's probably more to do with what's happening out at sea with overfishing and climate change and so on. In that part of their lives, as opposed to the part of their lives that they spend in our rivers.
And this river, the Inni, was famous as a great salmon river.
The reports are there for salmon and for trout, I think. Yeah, and actually, that's reflected in the fact that it's quite a good otter habitat. There's been various records of otter from along its length over the years. And of course, otters are what we call piscivores. Their main food source is fish. They will eat other things as well. They're quite opportunistic. But you kind of get two different populations of otters, if you like, in Ireland. You have the ones that spend most of their lives on rivers, and they are mainly nocturnal, well, crepuscular. So they're most active in the mornings and the evenings, and they fish in the waters. They will also eat crayfish if they're present, and they will take frogs or small mammals if they come across them, but their main food is the fish. So in order to maintain a good otter population, you have to have a good number of fish in your rivers. Sea otters are a little different. They tend to time their activity with the tides because they're fishing in the intertidal period between high and low tide, pulling fish and other things out of sea pools. But no, the fact that there are still good otter populations on our rivers is an indicator that the rivers are in reasonably good condition as habitats.
The names of the pools along the river tell us something of life in the valley.
There are so many pools in the Inni. There are, I think, more than 80 named pools.
Mary Murphy's interest in local folklore led her to a study of the pool names along the River Inni.
I collected the names, more than 80 names for these pools. And some of them are, you know, describe where the pool is. Some of them have the name of the people who fished there. There's the doctor's pool, named because a bunch of Harley Street specialists used to come over every year and fish just that pool. But then a lot of them, of course, are Irish names. Paul Fada, the long pool. Paul na Sop, for the sort of seaweed or river weed that grows there. Paul Calca, for the chalk, calc, for the clay, the white clay that's near there, that was used, in fact, for plastering walls and putting down floors. So the pools themselves are a whole archive of the folklore of the area.
Look, this plant here is bog myrtle. It's quite an interesting species. It's very aromatic. I just crunch some up for you here, and you can smell the smell of it there. It's almost like bay. And it would have been used several hundred years ago in flavouring beer before hops were brought in from continental Europe, and they became very much a more popular flavour. But still people would flavour mead even with it today. It grows in boggy soils quite well, and it's often gathered for use in horticulture, in sprigs, in bouquets and arrangements and so on. It's evergreen. It's an interesting plant. It would have been used as a strewing herb, so on the ground in the likes of Ross Castle or Bunratty Castle, the chemical which is giving us a nice smell also repels insects and fleas and midges and so on. Another one here that's adding a great splash of colour to the patch we're in at the moment is this purple flower here. This is devil's bit scabious. I've no idea how to link with the devil. But there you are, it's a scabious. And it's interesting, it has little clusters of flowers. We look at the purple blob on top and think of it as a flower, but actually if you look at it closely, you'll see there's probably 20 or 30 or 40 individual flowers on that head. And they're designed to attract an insect to land, but they only want to give their nectar and their pollen to a fewer number of insects that can fit a little tongue down into the tube. They're associated actually with one of our rarer butterflies, the marsh fritillary butterfly, in that like many moths and butterflies, the caterpillars of that species will only feed on a single plant, and it's this, the devil's scabious. So they feed on the leaves, they lay the eggs on the leaves in the springtime, and then the caterpillars spend nearly a year eating and growing, as caterpillars do. And they overwinter as caterpillars, actually, and then emerge as the imago, the adult butterflies, in the spring of the following year. But you need to have a lot of the scabious to support marsh fritillary, which is why it's a rare species, it's why it's in decline, because unlike other butterfly species, which may lay an egg here and an egg there, they lay gregariously, and the caterpillars live in big clumps of maybe 20, 40, 50 caterpillars all together. So there has to be enough of the food plant to sustain that big population. It's like a town of caterpillars, if you like. And it's one of the few flowers that flowers late in the season in Ireland. So it's nice to see it's adding a splash of purple to the hedge.
And another plant adding a touch of purple again that we expect to see at this time of the year is the heather, quite a striking colour over there.
Yes, of course, the heather, the ling heather, Calluna vulgaris, really important component of our boggy and heathy habitats in Ireland. And again, another, like the Mirica, another low woody shrub, so it persists through the winter. It's very slow growing, and like, and a bit like the scabious, it chooses to wait until the end of the year to come into flower, probably because it's taken, you know, the summer begins late in the year in the uplands, so probably doesn't have the resources to produce its flowers until the far end of the summer, and it does that then, and it's pollinated by bees and flies that visit from flower to flower, and it really can create quite a striking carpet across the whole hillside when it's densely covered in heather. And again, heather is a very important species in providing cover in these open landscapes that have very few trees in them, and the birds that occupy these landscapes tend by and large to be ground nesting. So things like skylarks and meadow pipits, snipe and so on, they would all need cover from predators, whether they're birds of prey like merlin or hawks and so on, and from foxes and the like. They need somewhere to conceal themselves. So the heather is very important in providing that structure and that cover.
So in this beautiful field by the River Inny, and in the far corner of it, there's an ancient hawthorn tree, and it really stands out against the rest of the field. And this is where the killeen is. And the killeen is a children's burial ground, a place where children who died under the age of 7 were buried because they weren't baptised. It's a very sad place, isn't it? Have a resonance all of their own, particularly for the grieving parents who didn't get the chance to bury their children in consecrated ground. A simple little headstone is all that was left to mark the burial place of a child. It must have been heartbreaking.
the Lebanese Christian hymn Wa Habibi, also known as the Mother's Lament and performed by Fairouz. Close to the Killeen, in the same field, and nearer the riverbanks, there's a cairn and a standing stone.
As we approach this mound of stones, which is now grass-covered, but it's a cairn, you can see that there are quartz stones, really quite a lot, dotted around the place. And then there's a standing stone. This is a cross-inscribed Ohm stone in the cairn. And there are quartz stones, part of the packing stones, keeping that stone in place. The fact that there's quartz here and it's conspicuous is significant because quartz tends to be used and found in relation to monuments, including stone circles, including the use of quartz in carving rock art has been found in excavations. So quartz is something that was definitely had a magical quality and a sacred quality. If you rub two pieces of quartz together and really hard, as if you're trying to strike a match, a flash of light will appear. So if you do this in the dark, you'll have a flash, instantaneous flash of light. It's called triboluminescence. Now, I've done that, and it is absolutely amazing to see that. Now, picture 5,000 years ago, the impact would have been to strike two stones together and make light appear. That must have been magical.
And as I look at the cairn here, even, the standing stone has a cross inscribed on it, and it seems quite fresh, doesn't it? I mean, it's very clear, the cross. I wonder, would that have been inscribed at the same time as the Ohm markings on the stone?
Well, the sunlight is perfect now. We're getting the Ohm and the cross in relief, and that's true, that the Ohm is actually quite hard to make out. And the cross looks perfect. Now, that cross might look like it was made yesterday. It was probably made in like the 10th century. Now, that might be yesterday in archaeological terms. But that's really quite a long time ago. The Ohm then may have been done in the 5th and the 6th century.
Are right down in sort of the middle part of the river, if you like, and you can see that the river has slowed down considerably. The river bed here is very wide, and you can see that lots of cobbles and rocks have been moved downstream and then dropped here as the river makes its way down towards the sea. You can also see that underneath the water, the substrate has changed a little bit. There's a little bit of accumulation of sediment, of soil and silt and so on, and that's allowed some plants to grow. Some of what you can see there, the long green fingers of water crowfoot, and they'll have little starry white flowers in the spring and summer. There's also some special bryophytes that are particularly adapted to clinging onto stones, and they can, you know, surviving submerged when the waters are higher than they are today. Also, what you can see along the riverbank here are willow trees and hollies and ash trees and a great big alder tree here beside me. And these are the remnants of a woodland type that would have been much more abundant all along the river courses across our country until recent years. And we call this riparian woodland. And it's dominated by species that are tolerant of being flooded some of the time and left out of the water the rest of the time. Very much dominated by native trees, very important for insects and bird species. And they would have acted as kind of conduits through our countryside as well to allow insects and birds and even mammals to travel along. One thing you might get here actually on occasion, if you were lucky, would be the quick flash of a kingfisher. Really almost tropical looking bird for our Irish bird fauna, that really azure turquoise blue with a little patch of rusty brown on them. The Irish name for them is Ancrúdain, actually, which means the hunchback, because they've got quite a short, tight little neck and they sit on a perch overlooking the river, ready to jump in and fish for some small fish to feed their young. I think they can catch up to something like 100 fish a day at the right time of year when they need it. But you'd be very lucky to see one. I don't see any here yet today.
There's a calmness that you get at this time of the year in the autumn.
Absolutely, and I think Keats had it right when he spoke of mists of mellow fruitfulness. It's that calm, probably before the autumn storms, when the air is still and you know, you can smell things are starting to decay a little or to overripen, and you know, you can really get those smells here in the air today, and it's not an unpleasant smell by any manner. I suppose it does heighten your senses, especially if you have time to stop and listen and breathe it in and take in the sound. There's a wren following us, I think, as we journey down the river. He's chicking in the background. You know, we saw other flocks of birds earlier on, but there is definitely a quietness on the river that's very enjoyable.
And of course, the pools were very important in the river for poaching salmon, because salmon was very important in the local diet. These were hard times. People poached and caught fish just for their own use, for themselves, for the table, and to give to neighbours who weren't able to go out and catch fish themselves. Poaching was done at night, and so they had to light the river, and this was before the days of battery torches and artificial light of that sort. So they had to make torches, which they did from, coiling up pieces of sacking around a sally rod, soaking it in oil, and then setting that alight and running up the fords to use that to illuminate the pools, so the man with the pike would see where the fish was and spear it. Another kind of torch was made from splinters of bog oak, which they wrapped around a rod or a pole, and similarly they would light that, and they worked in teams of three. The torch man ran ahead up the ford, holding the torch, lighting the pools. They called it lighting the river. The spearman was quickly behind him, very close behind him. He speared his fish, threw it out on the bank, and the third person was the bagman carrying a sack to carry off the catch. Now, there might be a fourth or more for lookout or just for the fun of it, but you needed at least three for a poaching team. And of course, poaching needed tools, and it wasn't just a case of going out, and you couldn't at night go out with a rod and line. And in fact, most of the people who caught fish illegally, as we might say, didn't use a rod and line. They had their own tools, their so-called spears. These were pikes made by the local blacksmith, who, of course, had to be in on the game. One person told me that he caught his first salmon when he was only 12. He was out making hay, and he spotted a salmon and what was to hand but a hay fork. So he employed it and landed his first salmon at the age of 12. So, you know, you didn't have to do that. And, of course, these people all fished with these tools. They didn't know anything about rod and line fishing, and they used only those. Whereas the legitimate fishermen were amazed and impressed by the kinds of catches they got. And I heard a story about a judge who was trying a case where a fellow had been apprehended with more than 60 trout he'd taken from a pool in the Cumara. And all that was bothering the judge was, how the heck did he catch them? He couldn't figure it out, because he himself was a fisherman, and he couldn't imagine having such a haul with a rod and line. This was what people did. This is how they caught their fish. And there was absolutely no disgrace in being caught and prosecuted for poaching, and even if you had to go to jail, well, that was part of the price. And you went and you served your time in Limerick jail or wherever, and you came back and you poached again. Maybe you were a little bit more careful the next time, but there was no stigma, there was no disgrace in being sent to jail for poaching. It wasn't like a regular crime. But I should emphasize that people caught fish to keep hunger at bay. There was no commercial end of it at all. There was, you know, it wasn't for sale. And it's not like today where, you know, salmon are endangered and absolutely no one wants to see them caught. It's very important that we protect these fish, and everyone recognizes that and understands that now.
So here we are now, just outside of Mastergeechee, and we're looking back along the way we've come upstream towards Knockmoyle, where the River Innie has its source, and we can still see the McGillicuddy reeks in the October sunshine in the distance. I reckon it's about maybe 10 miles away. And the river now really is in its lower course in the lowlands, and the land on either side of it is fairly flat. It's meandering along quite slowly, taking the easiest course, going through the softest rock and the softest sediments to take the easiest path, as water always will. If we look behind us then, we can actually see the hills of Valentia Island just across from where the River Innie meets the sea. In Ireland, just because of the geography of the islands, most of our rivers are relatively short, so they're almost like young rivers nearly all the way to the sea. Nonetheless, you can still see it's a much flatter course here, position going on. But what you can also see along here is something that's nearly primeval in the landscape, which is this very dense clothing of willow trees on either side of the bank. And this riparian woodland would have been much more widespread in Ireland formerly. Next to the riparian strip, then, we have these farmed fields where people have been making a living through grazing stock, or in former times perhaps growing crops for centuries. Of course, that way of life has changed somewhat now, and in areas some are reverting back to wilderness. Some, of course, are still farmed.
We've passed lots of standing stones on the way to this one, and I particularly wanted to bring you to the standing stone in Dury, because at 4.4 metres high, it is the highest standing stone in Iveragh. And to be standing beside the highest stone is such a completely different experience from any other stone. It's like soaring above my head, and it's really impressive and hugely monumental. You can see it all the way from the road, and just the closer you get, the more impressive it is. Now, not just is this stone impressive, like the view from here is the best of anywhere I've been in the whole of the Innie Valley. You can see the river wending its way below you. You can see the valley head, all the hills. Now, of course, the sunlight is spectacular today. But then over to the west, there's a stone row 150 metres away to the west. And then farther on, we have the sea.
Here we are at the stone road just below the standing stone in Dury. We've a fine view of the standing stone from here, and still quite elevated. We can still see the river as it winds its way through the valley, and we can still see the Atlantic out there to the west, and the sun slowly descending. And this stone row, it has a lunar significance, the way it's lined up?
Yes, it's lined up with the lunar standstill. This is something that occurs every 18.6 years. Now, it would take me 10 minutes to try and explain what a lunar standstill is, and yet 3,500 years ago, these people erected a stone row aligned on the lunar standstill.
Incredible.
It's a really large open space in this valley. So although there's an amphitheatre of mountains extending all the way to the sea, we have a huge open space of sky above our heads.
And of course, for people living in the Bronze Age, the passage of the stars, the changes in the sky were hugely significant.
They were essential for navigation. With the coming of agriculture in the Neolithic, there would have been really important to know when to sow the crops. All the agricultural activities would have been dictated by the cycles of the moon, the sun and the stars. Now, here we are in the ruins of this medieval church in Drumad. Now, there's a graveyard beside us. It's all uneven underfoot. It's completely covered in ivy. So we still have the walls standing. Can still see the narrow rectangular window. But the sense of what it was like when it was actually an active church is hard to imagine at this point. However, this church in Drumad, in County Kerry, in the remote corner of the west of Europe, was on the papal tax list in 1302 to 1306. Just down from us then on the river was the site of the romantically named Rainbow Bridge. That's now in ruins and hasn't been seen since the 1800s, but it was recorded that the High Sheriff held court in it in 1727. This is a bridge that spanned the River Inny, was 1 yard wide, and I just love to picture the court being held on that bridge.
Finally, we're here down at the estuary of the River Inny, just before it meets the Atlantic Ocean, just beside Waterville. So these are what you refer to as salt marshes, is that right?
Yes, what's happening here actually is that the river is tidal, so that the seawater is coming in and meeting the river water twice a day with the tides, as the river water makes its way out and spills out into the Atlantic Ocean. So it's what we call an estuary. And the land immediately around it, of course, right on the edge of the river now where the salt water is having an influence, is very much affected by the salt in the water. Most plants won't tolerate salty water either around their roots or in their upper parts. So you get a very specialised community here. So you get these things, we call them salt marshes, and they occur on the sediments and silt and so on that are deposited both by the river and by the tide coming in and out. And in fact, the area we're in at the moment here is a special area for conservation because of those salt marshes, and it extends just a small way up the river and it includes the estuary. And so the plants here you see have very specialised biochemistry, which allows them to tolerate salty water. So they have different ways of doing things, if you like. And you also see that they're quite succulent, quite spongy, almost like cacti, rubbery. And that's, again, to do with coping with the fact that some of the time they're inundated and some of the time they're very exposed. And there's kind of two levels that we look for when we're in a salt marsh, the upper marsh and the lower marsh. And the upper marsh is the bit maybe further inland that's only inundated at higher tides, which happen for half of the month. And then for the other half of the month, when the tide doesn't come in so far, they're left exposed. But actually, you might think that it's less salty there, but it isn't, because they are also more exposed to the wind and the air and the sun. And so the fresh water evaporates off of them more so. So they're actually exposed to more extremes of saltiness in their environment than the ones in the lower salt marsh. So you get things like the sea aster, the purple daisy-like shrubby flower. You get things like the Puccinellia, the specialised salt marsh grass. What else have we got? Some juncus, some specialised rushes. Again, look quite like the rushes in the fields behind us that are not being affected by the tide. But again, these have specialised structures and biochemistries to help them cope with the fact that salty water comes to visit them twice every day.
And we're getting our first shower of the day as we stand here.
We are. We've been very lucky. And the plants around us are probably saying, that's great. Wash away some of the salty stuff from me, please, and make my life easier. Yeah, it's a beautiful landscape. And it's very peaceful. And you look around, you can see the human influence too. There's golf links developed. There's also sand dunes, a semi-natural habitat, which are dynamic, of course. They will always move with changes in currents locally and in the tidal reach as our sea levels go up and down over glacial, over geological time periods. And of course, they're habitats that are very much under pressure at the moment, I suppose, with changing climate and rising sea levels. And then you also see kind of the marginal farmland behind us that, you know, are extensively grazed, by which I mean only lightly grazed, not intensively grazed. And, you know, a lot of abandonment is happening in general around some of these coastal farmlands too. So ultimately that might revert to scrub. And you do see in patches here and there, gorse and willow and brambles and things. And, you know, some people think that these are untidy in the landscape, but actually they're just part of the natural succession. And if left for long enough, they will go back to woodland, which was our native habitat, you know, our native land cover, going back through the thousands of years.
Following the Inny was presented and produced by J.J. O'Shea. The river theme that weaves through it was composed especially for the programme by Mark Eagleton and played by Mark Eagleton on acoustic guitar and Radun Schlesinger on the harp. Following the Inny is available to podcast from the lyric feature page of the RTE website and from other podcast providers.